the babysitter. Put on your pants. Come out with your hands up.
The following program is intended for mature audiences.
They used to bounce messages across the earth. Shows. Everyone in the old world had a show. Do you think there's still somebody out there? Sending shows? Who knows? Those are the planes of silence.
Truth, the half-truth,
and nothing of the truth.
Veritas News, now with Sal Manella.
Good evening, this is Sal Manella with the Veritas News. Elephants worldwide unite in a smackdown against President derelict Trump's lifting of the mammals' Obama poaching protections. In a statement by spokesman Mr. D. Umbo, leader of the Elephants Political Action Committee, Pachyderm, the mammals have, quote, terminated the licensing rights for the Republican Party to use images of their form to symbolically represent the GOP, end quote. D. Umbo revealed the elephant's ire, confirming that they are collectively angered over the president's actions, which they claim blatantly favors the murderous actions of the president's own sons. Members of Pachyderm have trumpeted complaints for years about Don Jr.'s and Eric's killing of big game. They say that Trump's recent lifting of Obama's elephant protections went too far. Additionally, since they never forget, the elephants have expressed anger with the use of their image representing a political party whose members exhibit a growing deficiency in memory. D'Umbo cites recent memory lapses in senatorial candidate Roy Moore, federal judge nominee Brett Talley, and Attorney General Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions. Other big game species like leopards and lions note that Moore, Talley, and Sessions are all from one state, Alabama, while the GOP is in every state. Leo, the king of the jungle, referring to feline game in zoos and sanctuaries throughout the nation, suggests that any notion entertained by any of Trump's sons to shoot them while in captivity would be grounds for a federal offense, as the Trump's attempt to do so would force them most certainly to cross state lines. Lions, leopards, rhinos, and elephants are considering teaming with North American bears. The bears, angry at Trump's removing protections, which had prohibited so-called hunters to kill them while asleep in their winter dens, have formed a coalition of grizzlies and brown bears to combat the Trumps. Calling themselves the Hibernation, they are seeking collaboration with American institutions to ensure the nation, and who won't, as they put it, cave on the issue. Major League Baseball has announced that the Chicago Cubs have signed on to promote Hibernation and will wear Trump-like hair hats on July 4th to signify the skinning of Trump, although the baseball commissioner fears that tickets for that game may goad scalpers to buy up seats, especially when it involves, quote, big game, end quote. And this just in, President derelict Trump has just announced the slashing in Utah of bears' ears. This terrorist act on these mammals has sparked angry responses from bears worldwide, with even Russian circus and dancing bears promising a walkout in solidarity for American bears. A spokesbear said, quote, "We walk out at showtime, Putin one paw in front of the other," end quote. In what seems like an inciting jab against Trump, President Obama sent what many are saying is a taunting tweet aimed at stirring the ire of President derelict Trump. He said in the tweet, quote, "My protections against poachers may have been lifted in most of Africa, but I'll fight for every lion, tiger, and elephant over my dead body. Someone would have to take my AK-47 out of my cold, dead hands if anyone tries to shoot big game in my country. No, they won't." Where do you stand, America? If you say, I'll join, yeah, I'll say, Kenya, 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 end quote. Trump's only response to President Obama's tweet was anger over why Twitter allowed the former president's entry to go over 280 characters. This has been Sal Manila with the Veritas News. Now here's Tom Savino with Savino Veritas.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth. This is Artist D.
And Anne Marie from Up All Night on 4 Culture Radio.
Have you got any wine, Anne Marie?
I'm completely intoxicated.
We love to wine. We drink wine. We listen to Savino Veritas every week at juicetalk.com. Don't we love Tom?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
How you doing?
Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and people of all genders. I'm your host, Tom Savino, and this is Savino Veritas, the fine wine of select gripes. In Wine the Truth, with the tastiest morsels available this week from the never-ending grapevine of dystopia. Tonight, have we created a cyber dystopia? And the trials and tragedy of losing Senator Al Franken. And animals unite against Trump. But first, let's all wish a very happy birthday to the godfather of internet radio, Frank Cotolo, whose Cotolo Chronicles precedes our show. Frank will be, I don't know, older when the clock strikes 12 midnight over there on the East Coast. I'm live here on the West Coast from Burbank, California, which, as I speak, I am sandwiched between any number of out-of-control and severe blazes. And as you listen live, wish me luck. I don't burn up here in Lion's Den Studios. But all will be well if you're listening later, some other time or day, on JuicedTalk.com, where this and all Savino Veritas episodes may be heard 24/7. That's www.JuicedTalk.com. Like I said, I'm the host, you're the parasite. Hey, Notre Dame and the Eiffel Tower are two wonderful parasites, as I recall on my honeymoon. Speaking of honeymoons, SRN1's own Phil Hung and his new bride are enjoying their honeymoon as I speak, and as you listen to this Savino Veritas.
Hobie didn't know what Trump's pitch was going to be. He was sure of one thing. It was going to cost the people of Talpa.
Be careful, son. I can sue you.
We've covered the subject of artificial intelligence a few times recently, and we're going to do it again today. We're going to talk a little bit about fears that people have about artificial intelligence. When people express their fears of artificial intelligence, the fears are often portrayed as humanoid robots running amok, you know, like the Terminator, or better yet, like Sophie, the first bot granted citizenship by Saudi Arabia, a non-burqa-wearing female robot resented by real Islamic women envious of her freedoms and stature. The fact that women were just given the right to drive in Saudi Arabia doesn't begin to appease these flesh-and-blood women, especially since Sophie doesn't need to drive now that driverless cars cart us all around. Oh, let's not forget perhaps the most fearsome female bot of all, Melania Trump, the first lady bot of the United States, or Flobot, us Phlebotus, F-L-B-O-T-U-S, Phlebotus. I think the medical industry offers special stockings for Phlebotus, don't they? You know, that might be something to consider. Humanoid bots is a distant threat, perhaps. Like living under the leadership of Nazi-loving nationalist fascist kleptocrats, that was once distant too, like Steve Bannon and Steve Miller's opinions, or worse, their faces were once distant, pleasantly distant, but not anymore. Or we complain or we worry about digital surveillance, like using references like Orwell's 1984 or other more horrible numbers like 45 to represent our current King Khan, and 8 to represent the unbearable possibilities of that number, the number of years he might serve in the White House. On the other hand, numbers like 45 might represent the number of years he might be sentenced to serve at federal pen. And 8 might be the number of counts to which he has been convicted and serves. Orwell's 1984 is not the most accurate portrayal of the 21st century techno-dystopia, however. We need not fear artificial intelligence harming us on its own. We need to be aware of the dangers of how people in power will use artificial intelligence to manipulate and control us. Much of the technology that we need to combat in the future is being developed right now by companies who capture personal data about ourselves and capture our attention and then sell both to others, to advertisers. Amazon, Facebook, Google, you know, the usual suspects. Artificial intelligence has already made gigantic differences in their profits. This has been happening and is happening right now. It may seem that artificial intelligence is the next step after targeted advertising, but it isn't. And what's next is big-time evil indeed. Each one of us has had the experience of sort of being followed around by advertisements. You know, if we check out waterproof boots for a trip to snow country, then for days or weeks later, every time we log on to the web, pop-up ads pop up and appear for the same product offered cheaper through a different outlet, or ads for other similar but different boots. Or if you're a guy running for Senate in Alabama and you search Craigslist looking for a female Senate intern who says she's at least 18 and she's mostly naked in her photos. Now, if you're Roy Moore, that's a pop-up ad, so to speak. Is those ads that mostly annoy us, those ads that we mistakenly think are ineffective? After all, we usually don't buy directly from them. Of course, in Roy Moore's case, he's looking for free samples, with a mother's permission, no less. It's probably no news to you that ad marketers have long known where to position products on shelves and in slats on checkout displays in so-called brick-and-mortar stores, markets, supermarkets. Candy and gum are placed on the lowest shelves or slats because they're at the eye level of kids who whine to their parents, corralling them through the lane to buy this or that candy bar or gum. Those shelves and displays in the world of advertising and marketing are called persuasion architectures. Persuasion architectures. Quick, write it down. There will be a quiz. What can be offered visually for purchase to the eyes of us consumers, however, is greatly limited to the space afforded to advertisers and marketers, to the limits of those units of persuasion architecture. But digitally, persuasion architecture is fine-tuned to the billions. And digital persuasion architecture is targeted to you, me, and individually and very specifically to each and every person on the internet. How? Because they've figured out our individual weaknesses preferences, and they can and are sent to everyone's private phone screen and computer. In the old world, an ad man would design an ad, and let's say an ad campaign for plane tickets to Las Vegas, and they would target, you know, the demographics, that, you know, the group of people that would buy, likely to buy, tickets to Las Vegas. They might say, let's target retired couples since they have the time, and let's target people with pensions because they have the money and the time. Thinking about what people generally like about Las Vegas, like its temperature in January, when you're living in a snowbound state of Michigan, they'd buy display advertising space in AARP, let's say, for retirees who live in and around Detroit. Now, let's just use one example, Facebook. Every status change you ever made, every profile you've updated, every photo you posted yourself or reposted from others, every conversation you ever had on Facebook, even every fucking sentence you've written but later deleted thinking, better not post that one, all of that and more is available to Facebook data gatherers who analyze your every thought and expressed desire or expressed hatred. Now, they also buy from data brokers your financial history and even your browsing history. Here in the United States, thank God, we're great again, is routinely collected, collated, and sold. Europe has tougher rules because apparently in Europe and Canada, people know that the word regulation and protection are synonymous. So the artificial intelligence of internet corporados, using their own learning algorithms, not only learn how to target, but after analysis of those who bought Vegas plane tickets, learn who to target and who to avoid in the future for similar products or services. Now, the artificial intelligence is made up of giant matrices of thousands, even millions of rows and columns of data, and not the programmers, mere humans after all, who call the shots. It's the artificial intelligence that's calling the shots. Programmers today admit that they themselves don't exactly know how the artificial intelligence categorizes us and how artificial intelligence makes the decision, targets and employs techniques that manipulate you and me. Programmers themselves don't know how artificial intelligence operates once it's learned, any more than you know what a man is thinking by looking at a cross-section of his brain. Unless, of course, that man is Roy Moore. We are growing intelligences that we truly don't understand. Now, because artificial intelligence in the realm of commerce doesn't work unless there's a ton of data on us, in order to get that ton of data on us, Facebook, Google, Amazon, the usual suspects, encourages deep and constant surveillance of us. Deep and constant surveillance. Now, morally and ethically, here's a frightening scenario. The corporate artificial intelligence knows, of course, that you are, let's say, bipolar. What's to stop it from targeting you for an ad to buy a Vegas plane ticket when it knows you are also about to enter the manic phase of your disorder? And it knows that the manic phase of bipolar disorder is the phase when you are apt to gamble heavily and compulsively and not care if you risk your life savings and overspend on everything. So what's to stop them from targeting you? Absolutely nothing. Certainly not this current FCC, and God help us, the current GROP, that's the greedy Russian ops, Senate, bent on killing regulations, and when those regulations are really protections. Can this happen? I suppose it wouldn't surprise you if you hear the answer to that is yes. But would you be surprised to know that it has happened? Yes, it has. A programmer with ethics decided not to publish his paper about this that detailed the results of his hypothetical scenario because it was no longer hypothetical. Because the artificial intelligence ran with the idea, so to speak, and did in fact anticipate the onset of bipolar people's manic stage and did successfully target them with offers that those bipolar victims did accept. But he didn't publish the paper. But not publishing the paper hasn't stopped others from using artificial intelligence in this nefarious way. Now, Zeynep Tufekci, a social scientist who studied Trump rallies when she was researching what makes Trump supporters tick. And well, after a few clicks on YouTube to view Trump rallies, YouTube engaged in offering to her, on her own little computer and phone screens, white supremacist videos as up next autoplays. The more she watched, the more extreme white supremacist offerings she received on YouTube. Now, when she purposely watched a Bernie Sanders YouTube video or a Hillary Clinton video in the midst of her watching, which was understandably overwhelmingly Trump-oriented because of her research, YouTube would offer as up next autoplays tidbits, right-wing conspiracy theory videos against Sanders or Clinton. Part of the artificial intelligence method, it seems, is to up the ante in terms of your likes. Watch a YouTube video or two on vegetarianism, for example, and the next thing you know, the web service will offer autoplays on being a vegan. Try it yourself and see. YouTube, Facebook, the bunch of them, the usual suspects, through artificial intelligence, has figured out that if they can offer you something more hardcore than what you previously watched, you'll stay on that site longer and longer till you are eventually down the rabbit hole of their control, all the time while Google posts ads targeted especially to you. Now, because no one here in this once democratic republic is minding the ethics store, these corporados can, have, and will target people who are susceptible to being a Jew hater or a Nazi sympathizer. Susceptible. This, of course, is what Putin Russian bots have, are, and will do to America's so-called freedom. ProPublica investigated Facebook and has found that if you are an anti-Semitic advertiser or pro-Nazi advertiser, you can post ads on Facebook, and, in fact, Facebook will gladly offer you help in expanding your Jew-hating or pro-Nazi audience. BuzzFeed tried the same experiment as ProPublica initiated on Facebook, but BuzzFeed did it on Google. Surprise! You could do it on Google, too. So Donald Trump's social media manager for the campaign has disclosed that they were using what they called dark posts to demobilize people, not to go to the polls, but to persuade them instead, to persuade each individual they targeted not to vote at all. Ironically, while Hillary Clinton spent the night, that last night before Election Day, in Philadelphia, Trump's Bannon directed social media scum targeting African-American men in key cities like Philadelphia, for example. They used, quote, non-public posts whose viewership the campaign controls so that only the people we want to see it see it. We modeled it. It will dramatically affect her ability to turn these people out, end quote. Her, in that quotation, of course, referred to Hillary Clinton, and it is It is referring to the obstruction of Clinton's attempts to get people to vote for her the next day. Just so you know, Facebook refuses to say what those so-called dark posts said that kept African-American males from going to the polls to vote for anybody the next day. Now, experiments show that what artificial intelligence algorithms decides to show you affects your emotions, which also affects your political behavior. In 2010, Facebook did their own experiment, which they've since disclosed. Election Day 2010, the midterm election, they posted to everyone in the United States on Facebook a little ad simply announcing that it was, in fact, Election Day. They took that identical post and added photos of real people they knew you knew on Facebook, and next to those photos, the phrase, "I voted." And doing so with the photos resulted in 340,000 more posts than the little ad without the photos. In 2012, they reran the experiment again with similar results. 270,000 more voters voted when they saw a little ad announcing it was Election Day with photos of their Facebook friends who said, "I voted." And that's an incredible amount more than without the photos of the people you know. What if that kind of cyber platform with that kind of influential power decided to favor one candidate over the other? How would we even know about it? We've reached a place already where you and I do not know if we're viewing the same information. Debate among the community is impossible because of that. And we're just at the beginning stages of this nightmare. These algorithms can easily infer your ethnicity and your religious and political views, our personality traits, each of our degrees of intelligence, and degrees of happiness, use of addictive substances, age, and gender, and on, just from Facebook likes alone. The algorithms can identify protesters from posted photos, even if their faces are partially concealed. These algorithms may be able to detect people's sexual orientation just from their dating profile photos. Imagine what a state can do with the immense amount of data it has on you and me. China's already using face detection technology to identify and arrest people. Look, we're building this sophisticated authoritarian surveillance technology now, merely for you and me to click on ads. Right now, because of the Trump-Pence fascist regime, they are using overt fear to terrorize us. But now we see, and we know it. We hate it, and we resist it, but at least we know it. But if these people in power use these algorithms to quietly watch us, to judge us, and to nudge us, to predict and to identify the troublemakers and the rebels, to deploy persuasion architecture at scale, and to manipulate individuals, you and me, one by one, through our private screens, so that we don't even know what our fellow neighbors are seeing, that authoritarianism will envelop and capture us like a spider's web. Freedom. We love it. We value it. We die for it. And yet today, really, we don't have it. We don't have it. We do have the freedom to buy our own brand of toothpaste or mouthwash. But the fact is, and not the alternative fact, but the fact is, we are the products being sold by corporados. Can we get back to an America where we are not the products for sale by the highest bidding authoritarian or demagogue? On that note, we can all call our representatives and the FCC itself to ensure that it won't be easier for the people in power to do what I was just talking about if we have net neutrality. It's our last hope. Net neutrality is our last hope to communicate to each other. Our last hope. I can't do this show if they kill net neutrality. You won't be hearing this stuff. You'll only be getting a artificially intelligized, there's no such word as that, an artificially intelligent, created idea of what you should hear, and that's not the facts. We must save net neutrality. Please do this. Please call 1-202-418-1000. You will reach a voicemail for the chairman of the FCC. Say your name, city, and state, and that you oppose the repeal of net neutrality. Net neutrality. It takes like 12 seconds. Again, you give them your name, your city, your state, and that you oppose the repeal. You oppose the repeal of net neutrality. The number again is 1-202-418-1000, 1-202-418-1000. I may be joking, but I'm never kidding.
Able to ask some questions and questions, but was able to ask some questions. And I want to just make a personal comment because I've been very proud, and I know Senator Harris is as well, to represent this tech community from California. But I must say, I don't think you get it. I think the fact that you're general counsels, you defend your company, that what we're talking about is a cataclysmic change. What we're talking about is the beginning of cyber warfare. What we're talking about is a major foreign power with the sophistication and ability to involve themselves in a presidential election and sow conflict and discontent all over this country. We are not going to go away, gentlemen. And this is a very big deal. I went home last night with profound disappointment. I asked specific questions. I got vague answers. And that just won't do. You have a huge problem on your hands. And the United States is going to be the first of the countries to bring it to your attention, and others are going to follow, I'm sure, because you bear this responsibility. You've created these platforms, and now they are being misused. And you have to be the ones to do something about it, or we will.
But first, I want to talk about something serious. And my show, every single day, I try to make people laugh or at least smile. I try to take people away from their problems and what's going on in the world. That's my goal every single day, to entertain you. And that will happen after I talk about this, because I have to talk about something that is very, very important to me. Everyone knows how much I love animals. I love animals. And so I want to talk about the elephant in the room. Literally, I want to talk about elephants. Last night, President Trump reversed one of Barack Obama's policies, which prohibited hunters from bringing elephant trophies into the United States. So basically, by lifting this ban, he is encouraging Americans to kill elephants. I love elephants, and if you take the time to learn about elephants, you would love elephants too. Elephants show compassion, sympathy, social intelligence, self-awareness. They're excellent at learning abilities, all the things I have yet to see in this president. Elephants. Many things I don't like about this guy, but this has got me. Elephants have an amazing memory. They follow the same migration route every year for something like 50 or 60 miles. I can't remember exactly, but an elephant would because they have amazing memories. Elephants are majestic, beautiful, thoughtful, intelligent creatures. This right here is an example. This is a mother helping her baby out of a situation. If you don't see sensitivity and thoughtfulness and love in that, elephants live in a matriarchal society. A female will only leave her herd if she dies or is captured by humans. True story, when I was 8, my mother left me in a JCPenney for 3 hours while she played bingo. It's another time. I was fortunate enough to go to Africa a few years ago. I saw elephants in person. They're breathtaking when you are next to them. This is clearly something I'm passionate about. I am determined to do something about this. I am posting this picture on Instagram. If you're as outraged as I am, please repost it, retweet it with the hashtag BeKindToElephants. And for everyone who does, we'll make a donation to the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust to help protect elephants. And if you're not... And if you're not outraged, then I beg you to take a little time, just learn about elephants, just Google them and see how truly remarkable they are. They are worth fighting for, and we owe it to them to protect them. They're extremely sensitive beings. This is proof. This is a video of an elephant who sees a man. I think the man was swimming, but he thinks the man is drowning, and he's trying to save him.
Senator from Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. President. A couple months ago, I felt that we had entered an important moment in the history of this country. We were finally beginning to listen to women about the ways in which men's actions affect them. The moment was long overdue. I was excited for that conversation and hopeful that it would result in real change that made life better for women all across the country and in every part of our society. Then the conversation turned to me. Over the last few weeks, a number of women have come forward to talk about how they felt my actions had affected them. I was shocked. I was upset. But in responding to their claims, I also wanted to be respectful of that broader conversation, because all women deserve to be heard and their experiences taken seriously. I think that was the right thing to do. I also think it gave some people the false impression that I was admitting to doing things that, in fact, I haven't done. Some of the allegations against me are simply not true. Others I remember very differently. I said at the outset that the Ethics Committee was the right venue for these allegations to be heard and investigated and evaluated on their merits, that I was prepared to cooperate fully, and that I was confident in the outcome. You know, an important part of the conversation we've been having the last few months has been about how men abuse their power and privilege to hurt women. I am proud that during my time in the Senate, I have used my power to be a champion of women, and that I have earned a reputation as someone who respects the women I work alongside every day. I know there's been a very different picture of me painted over the last few weeks, but I know who I really am. Serving in the United States Senate has been the great honor of my life. I know in my heart that nothing I have done as a senator, nothing, has brought this honor on this institution. And I am confident that the Ethics Committee would agree. Nevertheless, today I am announcing that in the coming weeks, I will be resigning as a member of the United States Senate. I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party. But this decision is not about me. It's about the people of Minnesota. And it's become clear that I can't both pursue the Ethics Committee process and at the same time remain an effective senator for them. Let me be clear. I may be resigning my seat, but I am not giving up my voice. I will continue to stand up for the things I believe in as a citizen and as an activist. But Minnesotans deserve a senator who can focus with all her energy on addressing the challenges they face every day. There is a big part of me that will always regret having to walk away from this job with so much work left to be done. But I have faith that the work will continue because I have faith in the people who have helped me do it. I have faith in the dedicated, funny, selfless, brilliant young men and women on my staff. They have so much more to contribute to our country. And I hope that, as disappointed as they may feel today, everyone who has worked for me knows how much I admire and respect them. I have faith in my colleagues, especially my senior senator, Amy Klobuchar. I would not have been able to do this job without her guidance and wisdom. And I have faith, or at least hope, that members of this Senate will find the political courage necessary to keep asking the tough questions, hold this administration accountable, and stand up for the truth. I have faith in the activists who organized to help me win my first campaign and who have kept on organizing to help fight for the people who needed us, kids facing bullying, seniors worried about the price of prescription drugs, Native Americans who have been overlooked for far too long, working people who have been taking it on the chin for a generation, everyone in the middle class, and everyone aspiring to join it. I have faith in the proud legacy of progressive advocacy that I have had the privilege to be a part of. I think I've probably repeated these words 10,000 times over the years. Paul Wellstone's famous quote, "The future belongs to those who are passionate and work hard." It's still true. It will always be true. And most of all, I have faith in Minnesota. A big part of this job is going around the state and listening to what people need from Washington. But more often than not, when I'm home, I am blown away by how much Minnesota has to offer the entire country and the entire world. The people I've had the honor of representing are brilliant and creative and hardworking, and whoever holds this seat next will inherit the challenge I've enjoyed for the last 8.5 years, being as good as the people you serve. This has been a tough few weeks for me, but I am a very, very lucky man. I have a beautiful, healthy family that I love and that loves me very much. I'm going to be just fine. I'd just like to end with one last thing. I did not grow up wanting to be a politician. I came to this relatively late in life. I had to learn a lot on the fly. It wasn't easy and it wasn't always fun. And I'm not just talking about today. This is a hard thing to do with your life. There are a lot of long hours and late nights and hard lessons. And there is no guarantee that all your work and sacrifice will ever pay off. I won my first election by 312 votes. Could have easily gone the other way. And even when you win, progress is far from inevitable. Paul Wellstone spent his whole life working for mental health parity, and it didn't pass until 6 years after Paul died. This year, a lot of people who didn't grow up imagining that they'd ever get involved in politics have done just that. They've gone to their first protest march or made their first call to a member of Congress, or maybe even taken the leap and put their names on a ballot for the first time. It can be such a rush to look around a room of full of people ready to fight alongside you, to feel that energy, to imagine that better things are possible. But you too will experience setbacks and defeats and disappointments. There will be days when you will wonder whether it's worth it. What I want you to know is that even today, even on the worst day of my political life, I feel like it's all been worth it. Politics, Paul Wellstone told us, is about the improvement of people's lives. I know that the work I've been able to do has improved people's lives. I would do it all over again in a heartbeat. For a decade now, every time I would get tired or discouraged or frustrated, I would think about the people I was doing this for and would get me back up on my feet. I know the same will be true for everyone who decides to pursue a politics that is about improving people's lives. And I hope you know that I will be fighting alongside you every step of the way. With that, Mr. President, I yield the floor.
Get a pardon from Trump or Trump. I'm Keith Olbermann, and this is The Resistance. I'm confident now, even more so than I have been throughout the last year, that this nightmare presidency of Donald John Trump will end prematurely and end soon, and I am thus also confident that this is the correct moment to end this series of commentaries. The important stuff first. There are seven routes in front of Trump. Each inevitably ends in his impeachment or resignation. The first, the likeliest, became 1,000 times more likely with the Thanksgiving news of a possible deal between Robert Mueller and General Michael Flynn. As I reported here as long ago as April 4th, the most specifically qualified expert alive on the subject of prosecuting a president, my friend, the Nixon White House counsel John Dean, put it to me very simply. Mueller is not shooting down. Mueller does not make a deal with Flynn to get Paul Manafort. He does not make a deal with Flynn to get Jared Kushner. He does not make a deal with Flynn to get Trump Jr. Mueller makes a deal with Flynn to get Donald Trump. Period. The Flynn deal report suggests Mueller has completely assembled the backbone of his case and is now just hanging the meat from it. And just as importantly, if Flynn has merely considered a deal from Mueller, it almost necessarily means Flynn either doesn't believe he would get a pardon from Trump, or that Mueller, as I've also reported here, has succeeded in finding a way around Trump's pardon power. And either of these near certainties spell Trump's doom. So that's the most obvious of the seven ways for Trump to go now. Mueller really will get him on Russia. It will be ugly, and it will tear this country nearly apart, but it will be necessary. The second way is, as I've also repeatedly suggested here, that Mueller doesn't really need to prove anything about Trump and Russian sabotage of the election. There seems to be so much obstruction of justice, from the firing of James Comey to the lies about Trump Jr.'s meetings with the Russians, that it's hard to pick out a key player in the Trump inner circle who could not be guilty of it. Trump could be impeached on just obstruction of justice and a few lesser charges. Nixon was about to be. Or there is a third way. We could be spared the trauma of a Russia impeachment or an obstruction of justice impeachment, as we were spared it with Nixon, if Trump is smart or just sufficiently scared enough and he resigns. Or if he isn't, those around him who could still sell themselves by selling him out will force him to resign. A modified version of this, of course, is the fourth possible outcome, that even if Mueller is months away from his denouement, the Republicans will impeach or remove Trump by spring purely to save their own asses. The state elections in Virginia and Oklahoma earlier this month show what could face Republican incumbents nationwide next November. Not only were Democratic victories overwhelming, but half of them were little morality plays. The 26-year-old lesbian beats the Republican in the district Trump won by nearly 40 points a year ago. The transgendered candidate in Virginia beats the guy who wrote an anti-equality bathroom bill. The boyfriend of a news reporter shot to death on camera beats the Republican pro-NRA candidate. I'll say it again. Richard Nixon was not forced out of office by Democrats, not really even by Watergate. Democrats controlled the Senate and the House every day Richard Nixon was president. They could have impeached him at any point. He resigned when the leading Republicans went into the White House and told him that not only would he be impeached and convicted, but he would take all of them down with him, and they were not going to let him do that. So that's the fourth way out. Trump becomes more of an albatross to Republicans, and more importantly, more of a rallying cry to Democrats, and the Republicans remove him before the midterms, and then, boastfully, run for re-election on having removed him. The fifth endgame is the same thing, only faster. The Republicans around him pull off that palace coup that is perfectly legal under the 25th Amendment, and Mike Pence and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell eject Trump by simply stating he is unfit and getting their majorities to agree he's unfit. And if you don't think Pence and Ryan and McConnell would do that, you didn't see Trump's crazy tweet about the Man of the Year Award or this thing in front of the Native Americans on Monday, and you don't know Pence and Ryan and McConnell. The sixth means by which Trump leaves early is, of course, that if the Republicans don't impeach Trump before the midterms, the Democrats will be able to after the midterms. If Virginia and New Jersey and Oklahoma are indicators, the Democrats could take the House and might need as few as 25 vulnerable Republicans in the Senate to vote guilty to remove Trump from office. But now there is a seventh new path to destruction for Trump, and it has bubbled up from the sewer of his life recently. And even with how Teflon he has been on this particular subject, it seems hard to believe the dam won't break. His sexual conduct. As not one snowball, but a decade's worth of them have come down that hill, wiping out all the sleaze bags and emboldening and empowering the victims, it seems impossible to believe that some claimant somewhere does not have tangible evidence against Trump, and that they won't say, to hell with it, and break one of those non-disclosure agreements, and Trump will suddenly be envying Harvey Weinstein. Trump himself inadvertently has hinted at this. The New York Times buried the lead on this over the weekend, but it reported that earlier this year, Trump told a senator that the Access Hollywood pussy grabber tape was a fake. And he has said the same thing, again, recently to a White House staffer. He's obviously trying to work the refs of public opinion in advance for whatever is coming next, from a woman here or from Russia. So, I don't see any way out for Trump. 7 freight trains rushing at him. He might avoid a few. He might avoid 6 of them. He's not going to dance his way out from under all 7. And we, I think, should try to put ourselves in the mindset of those Americans who knew Richard Nixon was guilty as hell after John Dean finished testifying on June 27, 1973. But we're all left wondering if there would ever be a way to prove it. And we're left listening to a majority of the country saying Dean was lying and left watching nearly the entirety of the gullible news media saying this was nonsense. Why would a president, even one as crazy as Nixon, ever do this? And more importantly, even if he were somehow guilty, how would he ever be dumb enough to leave any evidence of his guilt? And 16 days later, it turned out virtually everything in the Oval Office had been taped, and the ballgame was over, even though it would last another 13 months. Well, this ballgame is also over, and I don't think it's going to last another 13 months. And so this series is over. This was intended as something temporary, a 2-month project by somebody who had given up politics. And instead it became 187 commentaries and around 225,000 words and something approaching 400 million views. And I am proud of it, and I repudiate none of it. And it has been my privilege to do it, and I'm especially proud to have done these videos for free and for charity. But frankly, I have not enjoyed 1 minute of it. As I'm certain it has also been for you, for me, it has been unadulterated pain and revulsion and horror. The process has become nearly 24/7, and I've said so much that I can and have recycled old commentaries from months ago, and they have been fully applicable to breaking news. We've come full circle to such a complete degree that on Sunday, Trump tweeted a complaint about, quote, Russia, 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 the title of the 46th episode of The Resistance from last March 14th was, quote, Russia, Russia, Russia. I've made my point. So now that I think the outcomes, the 7 different inevitable outcomes, are unavoidable, I'd like to go back and enjoy some of my life again, and I'm going to. No illness, no scandal, no firing, just I've said what I've had to say. It was as obvious as I made it seem. I give my work everything I can, so it's not like I can dial it back. And I think even this dim-witted world of American political TV reporting, which is still calculating how to get Trump's idiot supporters to watch their networks and still waiting for Trump to pivot, even it can carry this the rest of the way. So I am retiring from political commentary in all media venues. This is not to say a bed of roses and reconciliation awaits us. The post-Trump America will be relieved of his prodigious evil, but in its place it will have Trump as living martyr. That prodigious evil and rank hypocrisy and immorality of his supporters, perhaps a third of us, will not vanish with him, and I'm not sure that the democracy has not been damaged too much to deal with their lawless, unprincipled rebellion, and I do not see this country's politics truly healing in the next 30 or 40 years. But at least the bleeding will be staunched. And we will have a chance to alter a phrase I heard somewhere, to make America, America again. Thank you for all the kind words and all the support. Have fun storming the castle. My work here is done. Matter of fact, so is Trump's. Resist, remove, peace.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Savino Veritas, you've heard it again, hear it again, every Thursday at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 p.m. Pacific Time, and all the other international times in between, and who knows, universal in the universe. Congratulations to Mr. and Mrs. Hung, celebrating their honeymoon in Macau. And Francatolo, happy birthday. It is now past the hour of midnight, and it is your birthday. Happy birthday, Francatolo, godfather of the internet radio. And remember, you can hear Francatolo and Tom Savino, that's 24/7 at the Too Cool for School website, juicedtalk.com. That's www.juicedtalk.com. This is Tom Savino saying, I may be joking, but I'm never kidding. Peace.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.
No, that'll be all. Just be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.